I'm Christopher Leiden, picking up the thread of a long conversation with Gunther Schuller in his living room outside Boston. He's been a sort of one-man vessel of many revolutions in 20th century music, and a player of many parts, too. He was a French horn virtuoso in orchestras led by Toscanini and Fritz Reiner. He's a modern composer, still winning commissions in his 89th year. He was a jazz player back in the day with Miles Davis, Bill Evans, and the Modern Jazz Quartet. He's also a principal big book historian of jazz in its early and swing and modern eras. And all his life he's been an instigator of things, like the ragtime revival in the 1960s and 70s. He is the man who first mapped a third stream of jazzical music between classical and jazz temperaments. So the thread in Gunther Schuller's autobiography and in our conversation so far has been the many musics in a sort of democracy of geniuses. Duke Ellington in the Pantheon with Beethoven and Mozart. Errol Garner's piano improvisations standing tall right next to Schubert and Chopin. It was Gunther Schuller's line years ago that all musics are created equal. By now, his third stream is inundated by maybe 300 world streams of genius music. In this second half of our conversation, I'm asking Gunther Schuller a question that I put to Richard Powers, the musically astute novelist of Orfeo, just a couple of months ago. Here's the question. Is there any summing up the disruptions of the 20th century in the tonality and the rhythms of mainstream music? And Gunther took it immediately to Igor Stravinsky, the Russian-born composer who started a riot in Paris in 1913 with The Rite of Spring. It's a riot that changed Gunther Schuller's direction, and in a sense, a riot that never ended.
I am one person amongst probably at least 25 composers of my generation who became composers because the greatest masterpiece of the 20th century, The Rite of Spring. And I happened to see it already when I was, I was a boy soprano in St. Thomas Church Choir School. Yeah. On 5th Avenue and 53rd Street. And in 1940, Fantasia, the great Disney thing, and there we heard, I didn't know it was just excerpts, but I heard this music. And that bowled me over. I mean, and then, of course, I immediately got a score and the recordings and everything. I've done so much studying and learning and being, you know, wild about some music and learning from it. But if I had to narrow it down to two, it would be Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring, and Schoenberg, an opera called The Erwartung. Mm. And those, The Erwartung was written in 1909, a totally atonal piece, and the Stravinsky was 1913. And I can't tell you, I just implied it just a little bit before, how many composers, when we talk about something, and I say, you know, The Rite of Spring, I had to be a composer. Yeah, me too. So many people. If a piece can be perfect, which is almost impossible, that anything can be really perfect, that piece is it. In the language, the bitonal, polytonal, almost atonal language that he used, which was coming in, you know, it wasn't going to stop, that happened at the end of the 19th century because people were so mesmerized, composers were so mesmerized with Wagner's chromaticism that they pushed that even further. And Stravinsky then did that in what is a very Russian tradition of harmony, which came out of his teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov. So anyway, there's this whole dramatically advanced harmonic language. Then there is the total breakdown of the rhythms of a piece, the meters. for the first 40 or 50 years of my life, I'm not bragging, I said, I can analyze any kind of piece, but this one I cannot. And I once had a conversation with Pierre Boulez about that, and he said, you know, this we cannot explain. I could go into a lot of details, even how the piece starts with a bassoon all alone on some damn high note, which bassoons weren't even supposed to be able to play. The meter changes are just incessant. I mean, they come and go all the time, and rhythms that had never been written before that time. The bassoon is soon joined by a second horn with one little note accompanying the bassoon. And in those three bars, every rhythm between a quarter note and any subdivisions of the quarter note and half note is in that one little solo. Dotted eighths, an eighth, quintuplet, a quarter note, a half note. I mean, in three bars to use every rhythm. That, you know, in 1913, that went way beyond anybody else. But then you have, you know, these incredible things. There's this one dance, I forget what it's called, where the music goes like this. Pum, 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 you know. And then it's interrupted by trumpets going, pum, 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 pum. Come on. Next to Wagner, even that's, no, it, and I get goose pimples just thinking about it. For years and years, decades, orchestras who could not play it at all. And then there were orchestras like New York Philharmonic and some others that finally got to play it almost correctly. There's a recording by Stravinsky conducted in New York Philharmonic where there are still mistakes in the parts. That's how hard that was.
Think of the music and the transformations in your time, Gunther Schuller, and explain it, as maybe only you could, to the rest of us who are just listening with more and less pleasure, but not much grasp. What happened in the 20th century?
This cannot be explained in any simple way. So much about the creative process is really not known. I mean, we know some things about it, but there is this other thing where something comes to an artist. Whether it's a musician or a writer or a choreographer, I don't care. That had never occurred to anybody. We do not know how and why that happens. One can say something that had happened prior to that time sort of had an influence to give someone an inspiration to take that idea a little bit further. But why exactly it happens and where it comes from. I've experienced that many times where I'm doing a piece and I'm doing, you know, my language, my style, and suddenly comes to something to me, and I don't know why it came, and because these things come very quickly, every time such a thing happens and almost interrupts the composing that I'm doing, I have to write down what I just, this new inspiration that came, because in seconds I will lose it. I will, you know, these things evaporate quickly. But it is that thing where somebody did something, a musical idea, and somebody, this is simplistic, almost says, gee, let me turn this sort of upside down and do it in a different meter. I mean, that's really simplistic, but just even that, mm-hmm. that's what sometimes happened. Now, when it comes to the degree of invention, as in the Rite of Spring, then that's really totally... some of the music in that is from Rimsky-Korsakov, who was his teacher, but I would say only maybe 10-15%, you can say, that's his teacher. And all the rest of it comes from somewhere. Imagination comes along with inspiration. I have been inspired by paintings. I've been inspired by other music, of course. I've been inspired by books, literature, poetry, many ways. I even was inspired in one of my first big pieces for the New York Philharmonic by a funny thing like this. I was coming back from Europe. And I had a window seat, and I looked out the window, and I saw a formation in a cloud. I saw a cloud, and I saw, wait a minute, I can take that shape and put it into music. Can you explain that?
Explain what a lot of people, and maybe me, feel though is a tremendous loss of altitude, loss of audience in what you guys call serious music in the post-Schoenberg period. Running headlong into this tremendous revitalization of music coming from Africa, from the Caribbean, from Cuban, Brazilian music, into popular music. That to me is the great story of music in my lifetime, how the Viennese tradition mm-hmm. became what I call the Havana tradition.
All right.
It relates somehow to what you dubbed third stream and a kind of multiplication of the possibilities
right.
of so-called serious, real, first-class, yeah. brilliant, wonderful music.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, look, I started that whole thing about third stream. And the term isn't used so much now anymore, but this was very simple for me. When I was young, this wonderful thing in our culture was one of the many wonderful things that I've already mentioned, that there were two kinds of music only two kinds of music here in the United States. Country music, and those things hadn't yet come into it. The only inkling of that was the Grand Ole Opry House program. It was just sneaking in on radio. So there was classical music, and there was jazz. Guess what was so wonderful about that? Of all adult Americans, 50% loved and collected classical music, and 50% loved jazz. Mm. So the entire population was involved with their music, of very great music, because both jazz and classical are enormously great musics by that time. Mm. But what was terrible and horrible, that these musics didn't speak to each other. This was racial undertones where the white musicians looked down upon jazz, not the musicians, all white people, more or less, looked down upon jazz as a degenerate music, cheap music. My father, all those German refugees that came here, they couldn't understand jazz. They thought it was some kind of barbarian nonsense or something. But the thing is, I said, This great music that is born on this soil, and by that time, you know, I'm saying this in 1946, and, you know, the music had come into our world already 50 years earlier and had developed with the swing era already a tremendous tradition. And for people to say that this is lousy music, there were articles against jazz I mean, Ladies' Home Companion, they had articles where the author wrote, don't let your children listen to jazz. They will get pimples or they will get gonorrhea. I'm not kidding. And I said, God damn it, we got to do something. Here's a really great music. And a lot of people love it. 50% of our population loves it. And the other side does too, but they don't talk to each other. They hate each other. And so I had this simplistic idea that the mainstream of jazz and the mainstream of classical music would marry. And as it says in the Bible, they would beget a child. And that was from the first and second stream comes the third stream. I was vilified on all sides, and it took 10 years to finally settle. And of course, today it's no longer an issue. But I'm talking about the 40s and 50s. The jazz musicians felt seriously that if classical music were to come into their improvised music, it would stultify, codify jazz and ruin it. The jazz musicians, almost none of them knew very much about classical music. John Lewis, I mentioned earlier, and right. A few others were, but that didn't come till World War II in itself. And so they became very bitter in response to this desecration of their music. Mm. I said, we've got to do something about this. So I wrote about this, and I gave lectures on it, and then it started becoming very controversial. And 10 years later, it finally became resolved. And now we have not third stream, we have 300 third streams. In other words, what I'm getting at, my idea originally was that all the folks, all the musics, on this globe, there are about 300 different musics, three in Borneo alone. Mm. What we call vernacular musics, bouzouki music, salsa music, all kinds of musics. Indian music, Chinese music, all these things existed separately from classical music. And some of them are 5,000 years old, which is pretty important, So anyway, I said, although I didn't emphasize that at that point, I wanted first to bring jazz and classical music together. But now, 60 years later, what it is that all the world's musics are potentially to be amalgamated together. The thing you have to do to make this worth doing is you really have to know the two musics or the three musics or the four musics that you're putting together absolutely authentically. Mm. You cannot predict what this amalgam is going to sound like, yeah. But except in my sense of the purest way of talking about third stream, that all these things are treated equally, really deeply, and then put together. You can name now any music you want to. I mean, there was about 40 years a tremendous push where jazz musicians went to India, or whether it's some new music that has come up recently, like bossa nova, it doesn't matter, whatever that is and how you then put it together, but not so that it's just sort of a little segment of this and a segment of that. It has to be linearly, horizontally, and vertically coordinated, brought together. Mm. And that isn't necessarily easy, but that's the true definition of third stream, except now it's, 300.
Vijay Iyer's story is a version of that, in the sense that he was born in Rochester, Indian parents. He had a lot of Carnatic Indian music in his head, maybe in the womb. And then he had a lot of, the run of the whole run from junk to masterpieces on the radio. Yeah. And it fascinates me that he, as I say, found his way backward in a certain way, into physics, but then also into Thelonious Monk.
Yeah. Well, you know, any talented people, and we haven't even talked about talent, but let's say there are such people who are immensely talented. Any person like that is going to want to do something with their native music and some other music when they find out that they also admire the other music, and then that it is not really something lesser. When they see that these two musics are both great, they will want to amalgamate them.
You've had a long lifetime in music, and your imagination, your knowledge of the tradition goes hundreds of years. In the case of China, you know, we're talking 3,000 years. But I want to ask you sort of report to the ancestors, report to all the ancestors on music in this 21st century. There are more ways to listen than ever before, and of course record and preserve. But how's it doing?
Well, I think we're doing quite well. Sometimes I feel, like I mentioned about certain things in jazz, that we could do better. But, you know, there is no way that one can... I wouldn't be able to argue that this music is worse than the music of the past or that it's better than... It simply is on the same high level in the hands of the greatest practitioners of that particular style and language. I've been thinking about this a long time. You know, it's automatically assumed that the music of Beethoven and Mozart and Bach, three of the very greatest composers ever, is the best music that ever was done, and that no modern music can possibly compete with that. I am very modest, and I took that for many decades as some kind of eternal truth. I don't believe that anymore. Mm-hmm. The Rite of Spring, by any kind of an analysis, and the Beethoven Eroica Symphony are absolutely on the same high level by whatever criteria or analysis you want to do it. It's just that it's totally different. And that we've learned from one generation to the next, and we are now here. And sometimes a particular era is a little richer in the amount of talent coming into it, you know? And one can then say, well, okay, we didn't actually have two great composers like Mozart and Beethoven, but we had one anyway. See, Ellington is on that same line for me. Absolutely. Because by any analysis, all the criteria, how we study the ingredients that went into a piece of music, whether, you know, it's rhythm, harmony, color, instrumentation, tempo variety, all this stuff, the forms, when you put all that together, there is a very clear development of the greatest composers doing that at the highest possible level through their talent and their industry. And if we do this now in a new language, does that make it less? No, that's what the prevailing opinion is. But that cannot be held.
Imagine listening to all the Grammy finalist music across a lot of categories of pop and commercial and small ensemble, big orchestral and serious music. What would we say? What would the Martian landing say about the sound of our culture these days, do you think?
You bring up an interesting question or point. Of course, we have some music which are called commercial. Commercial musics cannot compete with the great musics of our history. And by the way, great musics, I would include Indian music 3,000 years old. So it's not just our European composed music, you know, that we're talking about. Whatever the language is, it doesn't really matter. It is how the composer, whatever he is, you call him pop, you can call him this and that, whatever it is, it has to be done at the very highest creative level that this human being can create, that the human mind can create. I think that the pantheon of our great musicians, going back, you know, a long, long time, is really rather large. But if people are going to exclude contemporary music out of it as being incapable of being as perfect as Beethoven's music, that I can't buy.
Something seems to me fundamental has changed in our culture in your lifetime, even mine, in that borders between high and low, between pop and serious, have broken up the market, so to speak, in many, many ways, in ways that in Cuba, for example, or in Brazil, the great mass of the people knows all the music, and they're working in a kind of shared tradition, infinite variations and development too, but do we miss that in our culture or not?
This is, again, the way I've described New York of that time, because as I already said, and this is what's so phenomenal, everybody was listening to some kind of music with great love and devotion. I'm calling jazz an endangered species in this country. When I was working in New York during that incredible time with Miles or whoever, you know, at Birdland, I mean, in those days, there were 125 jazz clubs in Greater New York, 4 in Staten Island. Now there are 9 clubs. There's no venues. In Boston, when I first came here in 1945, there were 47 jazz clubs. Now there's sort of 2.5. So for the younger generations, there's no place for them to go and play. That's why when people say, well, jazz ain't doing so badly, yeah, that's because Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter and the elders of the tradition are still living and doing. And, of course, the whatever clubs exist will take them. I mean, my 2 sons are, you know, they're sort of near starvation. In Europe, there is a much greater devotion to their own music and our American jazz. And that's when my sons are fortunately invited about 4 times to go to Germany or Poland, where there's a big jazz scene. The thing about rock and roll and hip-hop and rap, I'm not really against it, except they have killed off jazz. They have pushed jazz in this country to the periphery and just hanging on. Now, these other cultures, South American and African and so on, they don't discard one tradition because they have another one, a new one, right? To make a great music of equal greatness, as I keep saying, push to the side where it is almost maybe going to go extinct. I don't think it will, really. But if it's that extreme, where thousands of musicians have to network together, get a little trio together, and hope that a restaurant might take them to play, and then they collect money at the door. That's how bad it is. There is no other such bad balance in any country I can imagine, including Europe. The Europeans have a just longer sight of this. When those people who went through Hitler and Stalin, who banned jazz, what they went through all that long decade, they realized that jazz is not only a great music, but it's the music of freedom, of democracy. And they cherish that. We didn't go through that here.
Gunther Schuller, speak of the music you're writing today. You're up to your neck in important commissions. How are they different? What pulls them together?
When you work so hard as I have, and all of the composers I know, we learn, and finally we start to write some pretty good music, and we grow and grow and grow, and finally we get to a point where we really know what we're doing. I haven't changed my language, my style at all, except I have done something in my style that is even more controlled, more inventive, more imaginative, and taking more risks. We do get better when we are talented and we keep working at it and perfecting art. We can never be perfect. But so every piece that I've done, okay, this is fine. But I learned early on, then the next time, three pieces later, I wrote a better piece.
You've got these 19 commissions. Just sketch the variety of forms, shapes, instrumentation, scale that you're working on.
Everything you can imagine. And of course, I enjoy that when there's such a variety. For the 75th anniversary of Tanglewood founding, they've commissioned again a bunch of works, including from me and John Harbison and many others. But in this case, the idea came up that Gunther should write a piece for 12 trumpets. I have been on commission totally ever since my early years. And often I wanted to write a piece or a form that I wanted to write, and I never could. You can't imagine how many times I wanted to write a piece for multiple trumpets. See, now here it came along.
We look forward to being in the audience. Gunther Schuller, it's a joy to hang with you, so to speak, and hear about an amazing range of musics and music in your life. Thank you. Thank you for the work, thank you for this conversation.
I loved it. Thank you. Great pleasure.
Gunther Schuller's autobiography is titled A Life in Pursuit of Music and Beauty. It runs 600 pages, and that's just the first half of his life. You'll find the first half of our conversation with Gunther on the Radio Open Source website. Mary McGrath produced and recorded our conversation with Gunther Schuller. Kunal Jasti edited it. If the life or the music's here resonated with you, we ask you to add your own joyful noise in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leighton. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.